Good. Acts chapter 2 is about spirit kingdom. Acts chapter 3 is about second sermon. Did I get that right? Because I messed that up last time. All right, I did. Good. Acts chapter 4 is about Peter's defense. Acts chapter 5, we have the first discipline and the second defense. And the first discipline was which two individuals? And what was their sin? Lying to the Holy Spirit. Good. And then, of course, the second defense, who was arrested that time? All 12. And what was the irony behind what happened there? That's right. They were arrested by the Sadducees that don't believe in what three things? Angels, spirits, or the resurrection. And they were released by the Holy Spirit and told to go preach the resurrection, which is just a great irony that happens there. All right, Acts chapter 6 is about the seven, and those are the seven that are picked to take care of the needs of the Hellenistic widows among the Jews. And then you have Acts chapter 7 is about, Stephen's death or Stephen's defense, whichever you memorize best. All right, Acts chapter 8, who's the primary evangelist in Acts chapter 8? It's Philip, and there's two key persons of interest in that chapter. The first is Simon the sorcerer, and the second is the Ethiopian eunuch. Good. Acts chapter 9, we meet the primary historical character for the rest of the book of Acts. What happens in Acts 9? That's right, Saul's conversion. And then we're going to learn a lot more about that as Saul continues his defenses and will relay the story. We already saw it once, and he's going to do it another time later on in 26. So anyhow, Acts chapter 10, we have a repeat, basically, of Acts chapter 2, but not with the Jews. So Acts chapter 10 is about Gentile spirit kingdom. Good. And whose house was that about, by the way? Good. The house of Cornelius. Then Acts chapter 11, Peter comes back to Jerusalem. He brings a report of what's happened. And then we have the first primary Gentile church, which is started in Antioch. That's right. Then we have Acts chapter 13. What begins in Acts chapter 13 from Antioch? I did skip chapter 12. Acts chapter 12, we have the first apostolic martyr, and who is that? James. James is put to death. Thank you for catching that. And then we have Peter, who's arrested, but then he's released by an angel. He goes to the house of Mary and says, tell the brethren about these things, and then he leaves. He takes off. All right, so then we get to Acts chapter 13. Thanks for catching on to that. Acts 13, what begins in Acts 13? The first missionary journey. And who goes on that journey? Paul and Barnabas and, that's right, John Mark. And then, of course, he's going to leave after they take off from Cyprus and land in Asia Minor. Then we have Acts chapter 14. If the Acts 13 is the beginning of the first missionary journey, Acts 14 is the end of the first missionary journey. Acts 15, we're back in Antioch. Some Judaizing teachers come up, and what are they teaching about the Gentiles? That's right. They have to keep the law and be circumcised. There's a dispute about this. Paul and Barnabas are going to come down to Jerusalem, so we have the Jerusalem conference, and the determination that the apostles and the elders come to is that the Gentiles do not need to keep the law and the prophets, do not have to keep the law and circumcision, but as pre-law, they do need to observe these four things. And what were those four different things? Yeah, that's right. No strangled from blood, no fornication, no idolatry, and nothing strangled. Good. So those four requirements. Good. And then we have Acts chapter 16, the end of 15, beginning of 16. We have a dispute between Barnabas and Paul. And what's the dispute over? That's right, John Mark. And so Barnabas and John Mark are going to go back to where? That's right, to the island of Cyprus. And who's from Cyprus? Barnabas is. That's his hometown. So Paul and which other individual? Silas. They're going to begin the second missionary journey. And so they leave Antioch. They go up way. We get to Lystra. Who do we pick up in Lystra? What young man? Timothy. Good. And then we go all the way up to Troas. Before we get to Philippi, who do we pick up there? Luke, the evangelist. And then the rest of Acts 16 is about Philippi. Which two primary individuals are converted in Philippi? Lydia and the jailer. Good, that's right. And then we get to Acts chapter 17. What are the three primary cities in Acts 17? Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. Good. Now, Luke stayed in Philippi. Timothy is going to stay behind in Thessalonica. We know that Paul's alone in Athens, so where is likely Silas? He's probably in Berea. Good. Then we get to Acts chapter 18. And then in Acts 18, we have the end of the second missionary journey and then immediately the beginning of the third missionary journey. Acts 19, all you have to remember is what city? Ephesus. That's right. Ephesus is Acts 19. And remember, you had the burning of the books and the seven sons of Sceva. And then later, you have the riot by which silversmith? What's his name? Demetrius. That's right. And so the riot takes place. They leave. Acts chapter 20. What happens in Acts chapter 20? We have two focuses in Acts 20. The first day of the week. That's right. They meet. And then we have the Ephesian elders, where they meet in Miletus. Good. And then we get to Acts chapter 21. Now we're dealing focus primarily on Paul and now his journey towards Rome. Because 20, we have the end of the third missionary journey, really. Acts 21, we have the end of the third missionary journey. And then the rest of Acts 21 is about Paul's what? Arrest. The Jews are going to come in. They believe that he had brought who into the court of the Jews? A Gentile by what name? Oh, he was from Ephesus. That's it, Trophimus. They thought that he had brought Trophimus into the temple. Good, bonus points for Brad. And Acts chapter 22, then we had Paul's arrest. Acts 22 is going to be about Paul's defense in front of the Sanhedrin. In front of the crowd. Then we get to Acts chapter 22, and it's going to be the second defense, and the plot fails, or Acts 23, and that's where we are now. So, Paul is now before the Sanhedrin. Claudius Lysias has brought him before them because he still cannot get any straight answers from anybody. And so this is where we started last time, and this is where we're going to start again. We'll go ahead and just start back over in verses 1 through 5 to recap. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." And we talked about this last time. Why is Paul able to say this? Because previous to this, what had he been doing to Christians? Yeah, killing them, persecuting them. How could Paul say that he had lived before God with all good conscience up to this day? We talked about this last time. Yeah, Clinton, go ahead.
He thought he was doing right. On the road to Damascus, he would talk better.
Okay. Conscience doesn't necessarily have to do with what is right or wrong, but what you understand to be right and wrong. And so Paul had lived in all good conscience before God up to this day. What he thought was right, that's what he did zealously. And when the understanding of the truth came to him, immediately when his understanding of what was right and wrong changed, who also changed? Yeah, Paul did. And so that's why he's able to speak in this way. Go ahead, moving on, because we talked about that last time. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him in the mouth. And then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall." Now, what is whitewash? Okay, good. It's when you would just paint over something that was cracked or something that was broken, right? And so Paul's point is, basically, you are a hypocrite. This is hypocrisy, because though he stood as a judge of the law, by commanding Paul to be struck, what had the high priest done?
Broke the law.
And so he was judging by the law, but yet was not living in accordance to the law himself. And so Paul answers him in this way, "Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck?" And then those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Interesting part, the word ruler there is actually Elohim, but it is implied towards people at this point. This is where we concluded last time. We'll go ahead and do just a little bit of recap. Why would Paul not be familiar with who the high priest was? Because that's kind of odd, isn't it? What did we... Okay, go ahead. Expand on that real quick. Someone said that.
He wasn't wearing what he normally should wear.
Yeah. Okay, this is a different meeting. Claudius has asked for this meeting, and we're going to see their meeting in the court of the Gentiles, which is not normally where they would meet. This is not a regular meeting, not a regular time, and so he would not have been wearing his regular priestly apparel. What's a couple of other things that might make Paul unsure about who's the high priest?
They change every year.
Okay, they change. And I think I have it in my notes, but there were some, let me see here. Between the years 37 to 70 AD, there were 28 different priests that held that office. So that's a lot of exchange within the office and from what we know historically. And so Paul would have been unsure of who that was. And on top of that, the high priest is supposed to be an example in purity and holiness and law-keeping. And so if he's not dressed like the high priest, and Paul just recognizes this man orders something contrary to the law to be struck, would Paul have guessed at all that this man was the high priest? By his actions, he's not acting like a high priest. And so Paul immediately understands, though, that his response, was Paul's response just? Was it correct what he said?
Yes.
But was it correct in who he had addressed it to? And this is where we left off last time. Paul took very seriously not speaking evil of those who rule over you. And you see that prevalent in the book of Romans. You see Peter write about it in his epistle to honor the king. And Paul writes in this way in Romans 13 to be subject to every governing authority. And so this is where we left off last time. There are a lot of Christians who do a lot of garbage in the way that they talk about our president, in the way that they talk about our nation, especially on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, and it's wrong. It's just wrong. And that's where we left off last time. And there was a good response from that, from some of you that have done that and had a regular occurrence of doing that. And so I just want to take a moment to thank you for your humility. I want to thank you for your willingness to conform to God's word, because that is something that's got to change in our lives. You cannot do that as a Christian, is go around and posting all sorts of garbage about your leaders and about those who rule over you. Whether it's right or not, you cannot speak about the king or our rulers in such a way. That is not honorable. Think about if we treated our elders the same way. Let's say the elders did something you didn't agree with, and someone got on Facebook here and started blasting Hewlin or blasting John. Would we react different as a congregation if we saw that? You wouldn't click like and share, would you? And so I just really want us to think about that. I want us to take that seriously. And I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for those that listened to that last time, for those that responded to that, because I've been watching this week and I didn't see any of that. And so there was a change. I'm thankful for that. And God will bless you for that. All right, moving on, because that's where we left off last time. Let's see here. We didn't get here, and this is just a summary of why Paul apologizes here. McGarvey says, when told, however, that it was the high priest whom he had thus denounced, Paul at once admitted not that the rebuke was unjust, but that it would have been improper to so address this dignitary had he known who he was. And here is a proper distinction. A rebuke which is perfectly just and right in itself may be improper on account of the official relations of the person addressed. That is a truth that we've got to own as Christians, and how children speak to their parents, and how we speak to our elders or the deacons, and how we speak to about our rulers in this nation or your boss. This is a truth that we've got to own, that we've got to live up to. You might be 100% correct, but the way that you address them is a lot of times is not correct in how you speak about it. So, all right, moving on in verse 6. So Paul is going to drastically change his game plan here, Because it sounds like Paul was going to start by making his own personal defense. He says, brothers, I've lived before God in a good conscience, and we can only imagine where he was going to go from there. But immediately, he's punched in the mouth. He has this exchange, and now he realizes he's dealing with a corrupt judgment, corrupt judges, because they are not even going to abide by the law. So Paul, remember, before he became a Christian, what sect of Jew was he? That's right. He was a Pharisee. Now, there's a big difference between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and we should know this from our memorizing of Acts. The Sadducees do not believe in resurrection, angels, or spirits. Now, the Pharisees, they believed, they interpreted the Old Testament scriptures literally. And so they, when it says an angel, they believed it was a spirit being. They believed in the resurrection to come. They believed in angels, and they believed in spirits. And so this was not like a Republican-Democrat kind of thing. This was a much bigger division within the party. Now, the high priest was of what party, though? He was a Sadducee. And you're going to see that that's prevalent through this time period. Rome identified with the Sadducees, and they ensured that a Jew of the sect of the Sadducees was in ruling over the people. They ensured that the high priest was a Sadducee. So Paul is going to know this, though. And so this is what Paul now then says. He says, Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, cries out before the council, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. And it is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. Now let's back up here, because it appears by some writers that Paul is going to use dishonesty to try to get his way out. And this is what they say. Paul claims he's a Pharisee, but how long has it been since Paul's actually acted as a Pharisee towards the law? I mean, it's been 25-some years, right? Or 20-some years. And now here, he says, it's with the respect to the hope of the resurrection that I'm on trial. But why did they arrest Paul? Why was Paul arrested in the first place? Why was he on trial? They thought that he was, one, speaking evil against the law. Remember, he first comes into Jerusalem. James says, hey, we got a problem. Everyone thinks you're teaching the Jews and the Gentiles to stop keeping the law, or especially the Jews to stop keeping the law. So he went through the purification process, and then they thought that he had brought a Gentile, they assumed, into the temple. So that's why Paul's on trial. So, is Paul manipulative here? Because he says, one, I'm a Pharisee, and then two, he says, it's because of the resurrection I'm on trial. Is Paul being manipulative? Okay, I hear a yes, I hear a no. Okay, Brad.
Well, he's not lying because he's on trial because he's preaching Christ most literally. And what is preaching Christ but the hope of the resurrection?
Okay.
So he is not lying in any way. It's the hope of the resurrection because of Christ that he is on trial.
Okay.
Now,
Yes.
But he's not lying or being deceptive in what he says.
Okay, go ahead.
And I had two thoughts. He's kind of pulling a trump card like he did earlier when he said, are you going to beat a Roman?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and the other part is I have to accept the fact that he's also being guided by the Holy Spirit.
Good.
So perhaps he said, hey, here's what you need to say.
Christ had promised, when you are on trial, the Spirit will guide you into what you ought to say. Now think about this for a moment. Remember when Paul got up to give his defense? And Paul told them what story before all the Jews, before they had to bring him back and now brought him before the Sanhedrin? What story did he tell them? His conversion. What was critical and paramount to his whole ministry and why he was going to the Gentiles? Who had appeared to him? What kind of Christ? The resurrected Christ. And so it was because of the resurrection. And if you accepted the resurrection, you had to accept Paul's ministry to what group of people? Which is why he was on trial. But if you rejected the resurrection, then you would also reject Paul's ministry amongst the Gentiles. Paul is getting down to the crux of why he's there. He understands. It actually has to do with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, the reason that Paul is going to spin it that way and also bring up that he's a Pharisee or was a Pharisee, he's not saying that I practice the law like a Pharisee. He's saying, in regards to these two parties, what I believe is congruent with that which the Pharisees believe. And that is, I believe in angels, in the Spirit, and the resurrection that is to come. And just like the Pharisees did. And so Paul says, I am with you guys. And it is your belief that is being challenged, that is being put down. It is your belief in this resurrection that I'm on trial. Now, Paul's going to understand it differently than the Jews would, because many of them are still looking for the Messiah. But here, as soon as he says this, it says, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. That is exactly what Paul wanted to do, because he had an unjust system that was not going to judge him according to the law, and a house that is divided against itself, Jesus says, cannot stand. So Paul here splits the house. You are not going to get a unanimous decision on what to do with Paul. But what happens next is not what Paul probably wanted. And let's understand why. Look at verse 8. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. I think that's interesting that that's here. Let's just take a big step back from the direction we're going right now. Remember, who's writing this book that we're reading? And who is it directed to? A Greek, Theophilus. It appears that he was not familiar with the differences between the sects of the Jews. And that's interesting. So Luke has to explain the difference between the Sadducees and the Pharisees here to his reader, because he wouldn't have known or maybe needed reminded. I just think that's interesting of note. And so Luke clarifies what's going on. Then verse 9, we come back to the story. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply. We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down from the Tower of Antonia. This is why we know it's in the court of the Gentiles. And take him away among them by force and bring him back into the barracks. Now, this word contended here, it actually means to fight fiercely. That's what that word literally means. And that's why it says it turned violent. This is unbelievable. Paul did probably not have this in mind for it to turn violent. But they start to side with Paul. Now, notice, they don't agree with Paul. Paul had claimed the Lord Jesus resurrected appeared to me. How do they argue against the Sadducees? Yeah, you know what? We don't think Christ appeared to him, but obviously Paul has undergone some kind of experience. Maybe an angel or some kind of a spirit appeared to him. Now, the Sadducees, to them, that's absolutely ludicrous, because they don't believe that even exists. So you have this battle that's going on, and it turns into literally a battle that's going on. This is no longer about Paul. They are not really fighting about Paul. What are they fighting about? Yeah, their convictions. And so now it breaks out into a fist fight. is what happens. They are hitting each other and becoming violent with each other because they're right. And immediately the tribune looks at this, and you've got the Sadducees who are probably trying to drag Paul off so they can kill him, and you've got the Pharisees who are trying to bring Paul with them because he's their leverage for over the Sadducees, and they're going to side with Paul here. And so he fears that amongst all this commotion, Paul's going to die. In some way or another, they're going to tear him to pieces or something's going to happen. So immediately, he sends down all these troops in to recover Paul and to bring him back into the barracks. And so can you imagine how frustrated you would be as the tribune at this point? You broke up a fight amongst all the Jews in the Gentile court, and you asked, who's Paul, and what kind of answer did he get? Yeah, he got nothing, right? And so he brings him back up. He thinks he's an Egyptian, but he starts speaking to him in Greek, and he says, okay, so you're not the Egyptian assassin. And so then Paul addresses this crowd in Hebrew, and then as soon as he says Gentiles, the whole crowd flares up again. He still doesn't get any answers. He tries to scourge Paul to get answers. Turns out Paul is a Roman citizen. You can't do that. Now he's afraid for his life. We're going to see that he's going to spin that very nicely here in just a second. The tribune, that is. And so now he's done something he shouldn't have done. Well, okay, let's bring him before the council. Paul divides the council. Now they're fighting with each other. He has got his hands tied. He has no idea what to do with Paul. And we're going to figure out that there's going to be a plot made against Paul here in just a moment that's going to help him to find a way to get rid of Paul. Yeah, Mom.
People wonder if this particular group of people was known for being fairly aggressive, because nobody was surprised when he was ordered to hit Paul, that there was no response to that.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Brad.
In our more last 100 years or so of our culture, we don't have this cultural understanding of two groups meeting like a legislature, and we have disagreements, it's all nice, and maybe there's some poisonous words or looks or something, but that's as far as it goes. If you go back to the first 100 years, or you go to some other countries, fist fights have broken out in these bodies when there is these sharp dissensions. I mean, smoke in modern times, there's been places where smoke bombs and other things have happened, and we don't have that current cultural reference. The Jews were a very zealous people for what they were in.
That's right. That's right.
And they were sitting next to them.
Yeah. Yeah, Wayne. Yeah.
They did not really like to be posted there as far as leadership positions, because you didn't want information going back to Rome that there was
problems.
Fighting, and
yeah.
You were supposed to keep cap on all of that. Now the tribune has got this tribulation going on underneath him. He's not happy about it because how it affects his image by his leaders. So that's a different frustration that he's got to think about.
That's right. And we're going to see that come out in just a moment with how he's going to respond to a plot against Paul. He's not going to decide, I'm going to get a huge force and just kill them all as they come for Paul. He's going to take the road of least bloodshed because there's already been enough commotion. And he doesn't want this getting back to Rome. And you're going to see that he's going to cover his tail in his letter to the governor. So the next night, now imagine, put yourself in Paul's shoes at this point. You have been torn around everywhere. You've been beaten. You've been attempted to be flogged. He's been struck before the council and probably got hit a few more times before he got out of there. Paul's terrified. And remember, before he walked into Jerusalem, they were all begging him not to go. And he said, I am ready not just to be bound, but to die. Paul is probably certain that he's nearing his last days until this moment. This is a crucial, critical moment in Acts. Verse 11, the following night the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for you have to testify to the facts about me in Jerusalem. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. Jesus actually appears to Paul again, and he gives him some comforting words. And he says, just like you have witnessed for me here in this city, you're going to do it in Rome. Which means for Paul, he understood that this was not the end. He was not going to have his life taken from him yet. Yeah, Brad.
Mm-hmm. Those in power. So when he goes to Rome, who's he going to be testifying in front of?
Mm-hmm. Caesar.
The Caesar and the household and those in power and that sort of thing. So it's not just going to work with the church in Rome or anything like this.
Yeah. That's right. Brett, Bruce.
I'm kind of intrigued by the men who have followed Paul throughout this whole effort, causing consternation, you know, turmoil. This had to be a fairly well financed and committed group.
Mm-hmm.
To seek him out in each town, cause trouble in each town, and to lead up to this point. These guys were pretty good.
Yeah, they meant business. And we're going to see that there's another group that's about to get involved, in my understanding, and that's this group of assassins that is known throughout Jerusalem that you can read in Josephus that played a big part in why Rome would eventually sack Jerusalem. They're going to do a lot with the Jewish war. And here's what happens is apparently there's a group that just as much hates Paul that is aware of what's taken place in the council, and they're going to side with the Sadducees here. And it says, when it was day, the Jews made a plot. We don't know who. And I'm gonna share something in just a moment to help us understand. It's probably this group of assassins. The Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now that's pretty serious, because if you don't eat or drink, what happens to you? They're saying, I want you to understand how much they hate Paul here. And I appreciate what Bruce just said. They're saying the most important thing in our lives is that Paul is dead. And we would rather be dead ourselves if we can't make Paul dead. Do you see that? I mean, this is unbelievable, the amount of hatred that's built up towards Paul. And it's also a self-motivating system. Because if you know you can't eat or drink until this man is dead, maybe by day one or two, you're going to start getting really hungry and thirsty. And desperation is a great motivation. When you're desperate, you will do things you normally would never do. And so these men are going to make themselves desperate, so that way they will take whatever desperate measures to kill Paul. And think about this. If they're going to kill Paul, Paul is under custody from Roman guards. So likely to kill Paul, you're also going to have to kill who? Is there going to be some backlash from that? They are basically signing their own death warrant, whether or not they starve to death or whether or not they're put to death by Rome. They just signed their own death warrant. They say, we don't care if we have to give our lives. We're going to make sure Paul's dead, even if we have to be dead to do it. Yeah, Anne.
Okay, it just says the Jews generically, so that would be a mix of Sadducees and Pharisees?
We just don't know. And I would argue from the context, the Pharisees would not be involved in this. They had just taken Paul's side and tried to save Paul. Why would the Pharisees then turn around and try to take Paul's life away from him and try to kill Paul? So as far as the council is concerned, it appears that this is going to be from the Sadducees. And the reason for that is who they're going to go to. It says there were more than 40 who made this conspiracy, and they went to the chief priests. What was he? A Pharisee or a Sadducee? A Sadducee. and the elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food until we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune and bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we are ready to kill him before he comes near." Here's the Pharisees' involvement. They would have been left in the dark. The Sadducees would have said, "Hey, we're sorry about what happened yesterday. Let's reconvene, and we're going to have Paul brought back down to us." And so the Pharisees would have said, what?
Fine.
Let's do this. But they would have been unaware of the plot that is against Paul. And that's, I might be incorrect, but that's my understanding of what's happening here. Because the chief priests and the elders, these are going to be Sadducees that are working with these men. And this is just, Reese talks about this, and there's several other sources, Tertullian and others, Josephus, that talk about this group of assassins that very possibly might be who we're reading about. Says these the assassins were especially active in Felix's time. And whose time are we in right now? Felix. We're about to see that. That's where Paul's about to be taken. He had already sent troops against them. And later they took a leading part in the Jewish war and the disturbances which led to it, being always among the most violent of the combatants. They held Masada and from thence pillaged the country. Eventually they were dispersed to Egypt and Africa, where they continued in their terrorism. The reason why I understand, when the Jews were beating Paul, as soon as the tribune showed up, what did they do in the Jewish court? As soon as the tribune showed up with all the soldiers, they quit. They stopped beating Paul. This is a different kind of people we're reading about. These are terrorists that we're reading about. They're willing to take anyone's life and even sacrifice their own life if it means they can kill Paul. So it very well might be this same group of assassins. It might not be. That's just, historically, it makes sense to put this group of men with their involvement in this scenario. It is a very big possibility. Whether or not that's the case, this is what's important. Let's go on with the story. Now, the son of Paul's sister, time out. Do we know anything about Paul's family? This is totally crazy and random, all right? We don't know anything about Paul other than it's very possible that his father was a Roman citizen. And that's how Paul got his Roman citizenship, is by birth, from birthright. And we have not heard anything about his family. He's never stayed with his family. He's always stayed with Christians. We don't know if they're sympathetic towards Paul or not. We just don't know anything. And so here it reads that the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Now, we don't know how he heard of this. The text is going to imply that this was not a 20-year-old boy or a 30-year-old young man. Sometimes that word boy can be translated a young man, like in his teens or 20s. The text is going to imply that actually he's fairly young, and that's going to be the way that the tribune handles him and discusses with him what takes place. But he appears young. Maybe he overheard something. You know, he was playing marbles in the corner or something and heard something. But I just have to say, this does not appear to be coincidence. What are the odds that Paul's sister's son, his nephew, would happen to be in the right place at the right time to discover this plot? I mean, is the spirit involved here? I've got to say emphatically, there has to be spirit's involvement here. Yeah, Kevin. You know, that is a possibility. The odds would be crazy, but it is a possibility. I can't rule that out indefinitely. But in my understanding, Jesus has just promised Paul, you're going to go to Rome. And now this plot, seemingly, that's perfect. No one is going to be able to stop this plot. The tribune, of course, is going to agree to bring Paul back down because he wants to get rid of him. The Pharisees are going to agree because they're ready to finish this. The Sadducees have this undergoing plot. Before Paul even gets close, he's going to be ambushed. And notice, though, they said to bring him to you, the chief priests. They've already set the location where they're going to bring Paul, so they know how to operate this as well. Nice sign, Brad. He gave me the stop sign there. And so this plot is perfect, despite that it gets found out. So we just got to get through this real quick. So Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." It is better to get the story in first person rather than by your first party rather than by third party. And so he takes him there and he says, "Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked you to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you." This is why we think he's fairly young. The tribune then takes him by the hand and goes aside and asks him privately, "What is it you have to tell me?" You can picture him taking this little boy and saying, "Come here," and then kneeling down and having this conversation with this young man. And the boy then tells him, he says, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, telling him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." There's a lot of secrecy here, because this is Paul's life at stake. Paul's not going to deliver this third hand to the tribune. He's going to deliver it firsthand, and the tribune is going to be worried about this young man's life. He says, "You don't tell anybody that you've talked to me." And so we're going to have to get there next week, and we'll wrap up the rest of 23 quickly and get into 24. But Paul's going to go to Felix, and the tribune's going to send him off there. Felix is going to take his case, and now the Sadducees and the plotters against Paul are going to have to go up, and they're going to have to, and I believe by threat, they're going to have to go up there and testify about Paul. And we know that they're probably in trouble because when they show up, they've got an attorney with them. And so this isn't just their game anymore. They're going to have to play by Rome's rules. So we'll get there next time, and thank you for your kind attention.